That's a good idea. Just saw on somebody's t-shirt over there, they've got the words infinite wonder. So that's the title of tonight's talk. Get all of a t-shirt. Infinite wonder. Because say sometimes that people feel in Buddhism the wandering mind is a bad thing. He was talking about someone, how to overcome my wandering mind. Well, don't try and overcome it. I wander around a lot. In theory, anyway. Always that story that whenever you can actually fly again, you know, that there's so many places you've got to go to, take the invitation to go here, there, all over the place, to give talks, conferences and stuff, which I don't mind going to. It's sometimes good fun, and you meet many, many different people and go to different places and see different things. And, you know, all for free. It's great being a monk. You don't have to pay anything on the aircraft. Just it's difficult sometimes because sometimes you don't have any money. Actually, not sometimes, all the time. But you know that I've seen in some of the customs forms, when you enter some countries, they say if you don't have a certain amount of money, they won't let you in. But they never actually ask me, thank goodness. Maybe I just look at them and zap them with my mind, and they just let me go straight in. But anyway, just wherever you are in this world, instead of worrying about what you're doing, you just do it and see what happens, which is a wonderful way of living. The infinite means you're not putting a boundary on anything. You're not just saying it has to be this way and it has to be that way. You know, even though, and people look at myself and then Wassy sitting next to me, we're monks. And monks have got lots and lots and lots of rules we're supposed to be keeping. We do keep them, but they're so easy rules to keep. Easy because it's just, you know, just being simple and being kind and being peaceful. You keep those three rules, most of the rules you know, you're already keeping. Just being kind, being simple, and being peaceful. Can you keep those three precepts? If you can, then you understand where all these rules, which they come from. But even though we keep many and many of these rules, they're easy to keep. And number two, they just make sense to keep them, just because they make life much more peaceful and happy and joyful. I mean, who wants so much stuff? Do you want lots and lots of stuff? I just really found, wow, how come in your house you've got so much things? Do you really need them? In my residence, I've got this beautiful residence, and many of you have seen my residence. It's called a cave. And I can tell you what I've got in my cave. And this is a mattress on the floor, about an inch and a half thick. It's got a sheet over the mattress. It's got one blanket, a pillow. It's got a little clock. And there's a water bottle, a cup. And there is, a dehumidifier. Because sometimes in a cave, sometimes the humidity goes up and you need to sort of get the moisture out. What else have I got there? I've got a bat. I have a bat. And the bat, you know where the bat came from? This is my cave? From IKEA. It's a toy bat which somebody put in there to give the ambience of a cave. And that's it. That's my possessions, my furniture in the cave. It's such a simple thing to live in. What a wonderful place. So anyway, keeping things simple and free. I don't know why more people don't do that. We have such a complicated life, and the more things we have, the more finite is our life. The less we have, the more infinite it is. I'll tell you why. It's an old little trick about meditation, about emptiness, about freedom. Is when you come into this room every Friday, if you come every Friday, you come into this room, what do you look at? What do you notice? So many people, they come in here, they notice the chairs, they notice some of their friends, they notice maybe the monks, a big Buddha statue behind me, the walls with hardly anything on. But you know what's mostly in this room? It's nothing. There's more space in this room than there are things. We don't notice the space. We just notice things. You look between the ceilings and the floor, between this wall and the back wall, the entranceways, there's so much emptiness. We don't notice that. The same way that whenever, we try to do some meditation, we look at all the thoughts in our mind. And actually, even in your mind, there's more space than there are thoughts. Even in your mind, we don't notice them. We only notice the things, the objects in life, instead of what connects the objects, what surrounds them, what's between them. It's a different way of perceiving life. And a lot of times, to solve problems, it's not just thinking more deeply, it's just seeing it from a different perspective, that's all. Changing the way you look at things. In this particular case, not looking at events, what's between events. Not looking at, say, a couple, but what's between the two of you. This is something which I've often noticed, and I bring this story in again. It's one of the classic stories of whenever I do blessing ceremonies for people getting married. And I just always look at the two of them and just say very simply, just from this moment on, you must not think of yourself. It's marriage. And once you're married, you must not think of your partner either. You must never think of the other. In a relationship, you must not think of him or her or me, only of us. So the third option, change the perception. It's all about us, not about me or her or him, it's about us. There's something much more than the two objects. It's what's between the two of you. And what's between you, that is where you get a little bit more into the infinite. The finite of things, what's between things is much greater, much closer to infinity. Just like this great planet Earth. Even though so many buildings we put up, there's still so much emptiness as well. Thank goodness we don't go to those empty places. They're a bit too remote and hard to get to, thank goodness. But nevertheless, it's lovely to know that they are here. There's more emptiness in this world than there are things. And I always love it when you see great mountains. You see great mountains, and what do people do with great mountains in our world? And why do they do this? When somebody gets to the top of a great mountain, what do? Put a flag on top of it. That's the start of destroying its pristine emptiness. Once they put a flag on it, what happens next? Maybe they'll put like a cairn on top of it. And in the end, they put a restaurant on top. Why can't they leave mountains alone? But anyway, they don't put a... Actually, they do something else with it now. They put a mobile phone tower up there. Whatever. Why can't they leave things alone? Why can't we leave things alone and not interfere? And just allow that emptiness, which is infinite. Yes. We try and make things finite. Mind try and make things accountable. Try and find the bottom line. Sum it all up. Find the total. Find the meaning. What if life doesn't have a meaning? Or the meaning is wide, great. What if, like, life's meaning is what you create? It's not something already there to control you, but meaning is what you make out of your life. I must prefer that idea. Years ago, when I was very busy and tired, and somebody asked me, what's the meaning of life? And I say, whatever meaning you give to your life. Not to life in general, to your life. So what meaning do you give to your life? You make the meanings. And that meaning which you make, why do you make it a meaning? You make it a meaning for the time being to create this beautiful peace and happiness and joy. Because there you know this must be the meaning. This was some advice which the Buddha gave to one of his monks who used to be his barber, and also to the first nun, Mahapajapati. He said, the two of them, you know what's the truth, what's the Dhamma, what's the teaching of Buddhism, by what it leads to. Does it create peace? Does it create sort of joy, meaning, happiness? This profound thing inside of you, which everyone recognizes, you know, which is called truth. And truth has to be peaceful, has to be joyful, has to not separate people or divide people, has to be something which unites everybody. And if one understands that is meaning, then not because it's even written in a book somewhere, not because it's intellectually satisfying, but because it's emotionally satisfying, that is much closer to the truth of things. That's why just coming into this room and always remembering to see the emptiness of this room, even when it's packed with people, to go, you know, through Perth and see just how much space there is in Perth, to see the planet Earth, and just to see just how empty that still is, and may it stay that way for a long time, to see the spaces between our planets. It got really cool studying astrophysics of the galaxy at university. It became so cool when you started to let your mind just explore this vast, this huge thing called our cosmos, let alone just a galaxy, the whole collection of galaxies. I couldn't finish the course. I just got blissed out. I remember that, just in the lecture theatre. Just wow, wow, wow. Simply because it was just so amazing. You didn't want to make it finite with all these equations and ideas. Keep it just unbounded by ideas and theories and words. If anything, if you are going to try and describe the cosmos, describe it in poetry. Because poetry is never meant to be precise. It's always meant to just to be that infinite, just wide, which you can't really peg it down into any one idea or thing. Something which reflects the nature of this universe. Wide, unbounded, infinite. And once you have that infinity, there you have the wonder. Wondering about something means you can't capture it. Just an aside. You know, many years ago, we were raising funds for something or other, I can't remember now. And we've made all these ideas to try and auction this and auction that. And I decided what to do was to auction myself. So I auctioned, I jumped on. You know, a lot of people criticize, you can't do that, you can't auction yourself. So why not? There's no one in here, according to Buddhist theory. That's my excuse. But when they auctioned me, the person who won me gave a big donation. It was to the Nuns Monastery, I think it was. Anyway, a big donation to the Nuns Monastery, and they took me to Bhutan. That's wonderful, going to Bhutan. When I went to Bhutan, and going to they arranged a little tour, and because I was a monk, and I was quite a senior monk, I got so much respect from even the tour guide, that when I asked him these interesting questions, he had to give me honest answers. Because in Bhutan, to lie or fib to a monk, that was really, really bad karma. So I asked him, are there any yetis in Bhutan? Why not ask interesting questions? And he told me, and he's an intelligent fellow, spent half his life when it got too cold in Bhutan to take in tourists. He spent that time of the year over in the United States, in California. He's very highly educated. And he told me, yeah, of course there are. And he said his family had a yeti skin in the house, which I thought was really weird. Have you ever seen a Yeti? Who knows? That's what he said to me. Wow. And I asked him where it was. Can we go there? He said, well, if you've got about 10 days to walk through the mountains in the snow, because it's remote areas of the place with the amazing things. It's one of the reasons why that just the wonder, when we don't try and tie things down to this idea or that idea. The other story which came up when I was thinking, what nice story can I tell this evening? Was, again, I wrote this down in one of my books, because somebody told me this story. It's an amazing story, especially for those people. Those people who just worry about things like economies. Because this was a story of a monastery up just, you know, around Bhutan, actually towards the west of Bhutan, in Ladakh province. And there was a very well-known monastery, but the monk passed away. The head monk, the abbot. And once he passed away, they had to, you know, choose another monk to actually to take over. So they choose this young monk, a very good monk. And so, you know, he started being the abbot, lots of responsibility. But one day, the other monks, they asked him, said, well, it's coming on to the winter time in the Himalayas, the mountains. Is it going to be a cold winter? Is it going to be a warm winter, an average winter? What type of winter is it going to be? So the previous abbot, you know, was a really good meditator. He could go into meditation, I don't know how he did it, but could actually predict really accurately what type of winter it was going to be. And they relied upon that. So they asked this new abbot, said, well, is it going to be really cold or warm, or what's it going to be? And even though the new abbot, he didn't really know how to meditate that deeply, he said, I'll leave it with me tonight and I'll let you know tomorrow morning. He needed to preserve the reputation of being the boss monk in the monastery. So that night he meditated, but his meditation wasn't that good. So maybe about 11 o'clock, midnight, he got out his mobile phone and he rang the meteorological office. Not just the ordinary meteorological office, he went to headquarters in Delhi and got through to Professor. And he said, he didn't say who he was, he said, up in the Himalaya mountains this year, is it going to be a warm winter, cold winter, or average? And the professor said, well, actually, it looks like it might be just a little bit colder than usual. You ask professors, and they always have to give an answer, something like that. Just like I looked at the news, the weather, this last week, it said supposed to be storms and lightning around our monastery. There was none of that. I was really disappointed. I like May, but it's really hot and muggy. But anyway, this professor, he said, yeah, I think it's, you know, a pretty good chance of being a bit colder than usual. So the following morning, the abbot got all the monks together and said, this year is going to be cold, but not as, no, exceedingly cold, but be colder than normal. So I think we need to collect more firewood. So all the monks went around collecting wood and storing it in the monastery, and 1 week later they said, is it enough? And the head monk, the abbot, said, leave it with me. I will let you know tomorrow morning. So that night, when all the other monks were asleep, he got out his mobile phone and rang the professor again. And said, Professor, how's it going? And the professor said, well, actually the signs are, you know, much worse than last week. I think it's going to be quite cold in the Himalaya mountains. Oh, thank you very much. And he hung up, and the following morning he said, last night, I reckon I have the message, he said. It's going to be colder than usual, so another week of collecting wood. So all the monks were busy collecting from here, collecting from there, as much wood as they can to keep the monastery warm during the cold, snowy winters. And after 1 week they said, is it enough? Leave it with me, he said. And the same thing, when all the monks were asleep, he rang up the professor, how's it going? He said, oh, surprising. The signs are that it's going to be one of the coldest winters on record. Wow. Okay, thank you. So the following morning, okay, monks, another week, maybe 2 weeks, of collecting wood, wherever you can. And so after another couple of weeks, this monastery was stacked with wood all over the place. Is it enough? And so the head monk said, leave it with me tonight, I'll find out. And so he rang up the professor around midnight. So how's it going? I said, oh. Said the professor, you wouldn't believe it. This is one of the coldest winters, I reckon, on record. I said, are you sure? He said, I'm a professor of meteorology. The signs are it's going to be really, really freezing. He didn't know it was a monk asking. But the monk couldn't help himself but asked, how do you know? How are you so sure? And the professor of meteorology said, well, actually, you know, all those monks in the holy monastery have been collecting wood like mad. That's why I know it's going to be a very cold winter. We always follow other people, what they do. And there's no reason behind that. But anyway, that's because we just don't allow life to be. You know, why do people collect so much wood or collect so much money and destroy so much of the planet? Why? Why do we destroy mountaintops by putting a restaurant? Can't people bring sandwiches? They don't want to go up top of a mountain. They want the view. What do they view? They see the person sitting opposite them in the table. They don't see the mountains. Even if they see the mountains, they don't feel the mountains. If you want to feel the mountains or be in a mountain, you've got to get outside the restaurant. Feel the cold air. Crunch the snow. I know that's a wonderful thing, the infinite wandering. Because that's one of the other little stories. I love telling these stories, especially this one, simply because it brings back to me the feeling of just such utter peace in some of the most unusual places. And this was so many years ago when I was visiting UK, and it was, I don't know why I did this, I was a really stupid monk, because I decided to go to visit UK during the winter time. You know why? Christmas. So that's your tradition. It's a stupid tradition. See, because it's so cold and it's also depressing. That is where I learnt. It's my brother who picked me up from the airport. I actually got, this is a true story, couldn't believe this. I came out of Heathrow Airport and I said, where's my brother? He's supposed to be picking me up. And he didn't recognise me. I said, look, I'm wearing robes. I'm the only person come out with robes. Oh yeah, okay, fair enough. I don't know why he didn't. Anyway, it's a true story. You can ask him if ever you see him. But anyway, just I went to this monastery. And it was just a new monastery. And this particular year was an incredibly cold year. The source of year when any monks would be putting lots and lots of wood in their monastery where they could find it. But because you were visiting, monk, I had no responsibilities. I love being a visitor. Sometimes I pretend to be a visitor in Bodhinyana Monastery where I live. Honestly, I do. Because then, because I don't own it, I can enjoy it just like you do. Can you enjoy your own home? If you own it, you've got responsibility. It's not clean enough, it's dirty, it's need this here and that there. Now, if I think I own Bodhinyana Monastery, then I've got all these responsibilities. I can't enjoy it. Every now and again, I pretend to be a visitor. Just like you. And it's so peaceful. It's so beautiful. When you pretend to be a visitor. Always try that in your own home. In your garden. That house which you, or apartment you paid so much money for. Pretend you're visiting. You don't have to wash up. You don't have to sweep anything. Just enjoy it. Freedom. Anyway, because I was a visitor, I had no responsibilities, no duties. So I decided it had snowed the night before. The following day that I saw in the newspapers, the temperature, if I remember it correctly, minus 36 degrees. Really incredibly cold. So they closed down the airports. There was nothing on the roads. So when I went out, and they say only mad monks and Englishmen go out in the... This was say midday sun, this is in the wintry cold. I had boots on and scarves and woolly hats and everything. So I was quite insulated from the freezing cold. But it was one of the most magnificent experiences of my life. Because when I went out into the snowy forest, the snow was thick. And there's no vehicles to be heard anywhere. There's no aircraft in the skies because they couldn't take off from the airports. There's no cars on the roads. The roads were too icy. And even the animals, there's no birds in the sky. They were all hibernating, keeping warm. All human beings were the same. They were hibernating in their beds, keeping warm. And all the little animals usually scurry on the floor of the ground of the forest. They were all hibernating as well. Everything was just perfectly still, except for me, walking in this forest. But when you're in great experiences like that, it's if like you're alone in the whole world. There's no one else in the world. You own that forest, but you've got no responsibility for it. Because there's no one else to be seen or heard anywhere. That wasn't scary, that was just brilliant. Every time I had one step and you could hear the snow crunch under your boots, that was the only sound. And I stopped, and the whole world stopped with me. That was powerful. It was beautiful. It was worth the freezing temperature to experience the whole world stopping in Europe. Just for a second. More than a second. A few seconds. Those sorts of feelings of silence, when the mind has wandered, but now it pauses and stops. As you experience and appreciate the wonderful space between things. And one thing you notice when you experience that space, that silence, that's what connects us. The emptiness, the peace, the beauty. And that is what is really holy and spiritual. The word spirituality is not just words or acts. A lot of time it's a silence. For those of you with partners, just sit together every now and again in silence, being with one another, but not disturbing that silence, that trust, that peace. Be able to sit silently in a forest like one of the Anagarikas did a few years ago, just on the opposite side of Kingsbury Drive to Bodhinyana Monastery. He was sitting there so peacefully, under a tree, and this big animal came to him. It was an emu. An emu. There was a few emus around there. We see them every now and again, but they are very, very timid. And they would just run away from human beings. But this training monk was sitting so still, so peaceful. He had his eyes open. And the emu just came right up to him with his big beak, just sniffed him. And he didn't move. And the emu just hopped away again, peacefully, not disturbed at all. What a beautiful experience that is. To be so still and peaceful that you can connect in that silence and that peace with these amazing animals like emus. Of course, you know, when I was in Thailand, you connect with other animals. Like snakes. Not just in Thailand, but also in Australia. I haven't seen it for a while now, because I've been staying in my cave. You don't see anything in my cave. But I remember on the time when I went on the 6-month retreat, I was just finishing my food on a hot summer's day. I went outside to wash my bowl. There's this big dugite snake. I realized it was coming because all the kangaroos were hopping away. It was really weird. This huge snake is 2.8 meters long. And I know it's 2.8 meters long because it came to shade itself from the hot sun of my hut. And I built that hut. I know the wall where it was shading itself was 2.8 meters long. And it just sat there, its head and its tail, you know, without sort of curling up. When it first came, I was just washing my body, it came right up to me. As if to look, who is this fellow? And I was just quite happily doing my bowl. And so I just paid it no attention at first because I had to wash my bowl. When I looked again, it had turned around and its tail was pointing at me, its head was the other direction. It trusted me so much. And she's a dangerous animal, very deadly. You could be its friend, because what you connected with was the peace and the kindness and the fearlessness. And there was nothing which I would ever do to harm that little animal. A big animal, very big. Something the biggest snake I've seen over here in... Oh, there's another snake I remember. I don't know where it came from. I don't know where it went, but it's a python. Somebody let go a python in our monastery, and I was doing my walking meditation under the shade of my walking meditation roof. You know that sometimes, you know, you're doing your walking meditation, just looking in front of you. Sometimes you feel that something's watching you. I looked up, and there was a big python up there. His head was coming down from the rafters looking at me, and I was looking at him or her. I'm not quite sure what the gender is. Actually, I don't know how to find out the gender. I don't ask them. But there must be some way they know anyway. But anyway, I just had a look, said hello, and then carried on walking. And of course, if you're so peaceful like that, the animals never harm you at all. But probably the couple of most interesting snake stories, I think I told last week the story about giving holy water to a snake. Remember that one last week? But there's another time we were doing a ceremony once. And I was doing the chanting of this ceremony we do every 2 weeks. So I was up there doing the chanting. And there was another monk in front of me. He had his hands up like this. And I noticed just from his back, his head popped up. Snake. The snake had crawled up his back. And the snake, so you guys could see its head. And the snake could see me. But the snake couldn't see the monk. And the monk couldn't see the snake yet. But I realized something was going on. So I had this wonderful, bizarre moment when these two animals, the monk and the snake, turn around to look at each other. You know, sometimes you have these experiences, and I'm not exaggerating. You wish, you know, you had a camera like a... This is so many years ago, they didn't have cameras, especially that part of Thailand. But to photograph it, that would be wonderful. This little snake and the monk just looking at one another, eyeballing, only just a few inches apart. And no, the snake wasn't afraid, the monk wasn't afraid, he just very carefully just put his robe down, so the snake could just go down on the ground and just crawl slowly away. Why did that happen? Why wasn't he bit? Again, it's because of the kindness between the two of them. Something which we focused on. What connects us, not what divides us. Different species. Who is the dangerous one, the snake or the monk? Human beings are far more dangerous than snakes. More snakes are being killed by humans than humans by snakes. So, when we just kind to one another, of course the snake doesn't bother at all. Just comes down and just crawls away somewhere. So little by little you can see that when we see what connects us, what's between us, rather than what separates us, that's where we can have so much more infinity and peace. And wonder about our life in this world. People still have too many problems with religions. And sometimes, unfortunately, religions divide people. They don't need to do that. So many years ago, when I was teaching at a conference in UWA, a chaplaincy conference, that whoever was organizing this was great, because they put me to present alongside the abbot of New Norcia Monastery. Well, that time was Abbot Placid, who, you know, became a really good friend of mine. If ever you go down to Bodhinyana Monastery, in the room where we have all the food put out, you look at some of the pictures on the wall there, and you see the picture of all the monks from New Norcia and all the monks from Bodhinyana Monastery. We met together, and they've got a lovely picture of us all next to the bell tower in Bodhinyana Monastery, with a huge smile, Abbot Placid, and a huge smile from Ajahn Brahm. We became such good friends that when he actually passed away, that I was allowed, invited. He said, "You have to come to the funeral mass at St. Joseph's, or whatever, it's one of the Catholic churches in Subiaco." But anyway, because we were good friends, we'd talk and we'd also crack jokes together. So I remember just when he took me around this old monastery in New Norcia, And they took me around there, gave me the private sort of tour around. And I asked them, if you've ever been inside that place, whoa, it's pretty spooky. It's so old. So I asked him, I said, no, Abbot Placid, you know, we're friends, you can confide in me. Are there any ghosts in this monastery? And he turned around and looked at me and said, Ajahn Brahma, I thought you knew better. As Catholics, we don't believe in ghosts. He said in all seriousness. And I looked him in the eyes and said, what about the Holy Ghost then? Ha ha, got you. So we used to tell jokes to each other. You do believe in ghosts, at least the Holy Ghost. But anyway, so we had this conference presenting a UWA. And that was the time in the audience, they had this gentleman there called Father Frank Brennan from Sydney, or around the area anyway. And he's this intellectual heavyweight. I read about him. You know, he's like a professor. And he was one of the people, he was the person, selected by the government many years ago to write to head a little committee to write an edition, a human rights edition to the Australian Constitution. So this was really a heavyweight sort of intellect. So he was in my audience. So he asked me this question. And I realized you can't tell a joke to a person like that. I was tempted, but no, I better not. So the question he asked me was a wonderful question, very simple. He said, you know, he'd been listening to me, and he said, what is the Buddhist idea of God? Now, you just can't say, well, Buddhists don't believe in God. That doesn't take things anywhere. Said, well, I mentioned that Albert Placid was next to me. I decided to give a really honest answer, but an answer which takes things deeper. Said, well, my friend Abbot Placid has been telling me for years, in all our friendship, he's been telling me that one of his basic ideas of life was that everyone is searching for God. Now, from a Catholic leader, you know, you can think, understand that, but let's stop for a while. I respect this man. I'm not a Catholic. I'm a Buddhist. So what are Buddhists, what are they searching for? What are you searching for when you come here? What do atheists search for? So going on that direction, that line of exploration, what you're searching for, you can add many more things to this list I'm going to give you now. You know, we seek for meaning in life, for joy, for purpose. So we can add something to this planet Earth and not destroy things after our time here. We want the joy of being loved and the wonderful pleasure of giving that love to somebody else. We want the wonderful joy of search, exploration, finding out new things, safety. What we search for, what many people search for, is something as simple as respect. We want to be respected. That opened up a huge area for me when we explored and found, yeah, so many people with mental illnesses, physical deformities, thinking they're failures in life, things not going well for them. What they really, 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 really want is just to be respected by others. They've tried their very best. There's not nothing wrong with them. Just things haven't worked out so well. How much is respect such a valuable thing which we all search for? And so look, whoever you meet in life, that's a very simple thing you can give. And so well regarded, you give respect to somebody, and they respect you back. You've made a connection there. So I had all these lists of what people search for in life, what you search for in life, what you would want in your life. Peace. As I said earlier, peace is a huge thing. And to find out what peace actually is, and to know it so well, be able to sort of abide in that peace, personal, inside of yourself, no matter what happens in the world. You know, sometimes things go well in the day, sometimes they go terribly. Welcome to our world, our life. We want to be able to find peace no matter what. When your loved ones, you know, pass away or get very sick, and there's tragedies in this world. To be able to know where peace is, where everything goes wrong. When you can find that, oh, you've found like a gold mine. These are what people search for. So then I said, well, if everyone's searching for God, what my friend Abbot Placid said, that's what everyone is searching for who I know. That must be what God is. So that's the Buddhist idea of God. Peace, respect, meaning, kindness, love, both to give and to receive, and many, many more things. I mean, the Father Frank better to say, well, yeah, I can accept that, well done. And getting a well done from an intellect like that as a Catholic, I was very proud of that. But what it was that just, it takes our world deeper. And the reason why I was very happy with that answer, which was just, again, like many things which I do on the spot, another reason why you do it on the spot, because if you follow the texts, if you follow what other people tell you, it's not alive anymore. It's just dead stuff, old people's ideas. But you say it from anew, and it has much more power to it. And it's also, I said, it's something which no one needs. If you're a Muslim, or if you're a Christian, or if you're a Presbyterian, or Pentecostalist. Isn't that what most people would like to find in life, what they search for? So it's something which unites people. It's not based on dogma anymore. It's based on the emotional truths of our life when we connect with one another. And so sometimes when we wonder about things, if you are wandering, if your mind is wandering and just exploring, please let it explore, but don't let it explore in old territories where you've been so many times before. If you have a wandering mind, how about wandering somewhere new this time? Not in your old fears, in your old sort of, you know, fantasies. How about wandering somewhere fresh? It is beautiful ideas of peace and respect, meaning. Even something like, it's weird, you know, sometimes we mention these words, but how much of these emotions do you really know properly? Even something like love. Do you really know what that word means? And do you find me a caring, loving monk? You're a monk and you know how to love? And I think you probably will know that yes, you do. How do you know what that meaning is? You can take it much deeper. If you want to wander and find out what love truly means. And I got my first hint from my father, of course, who told me that, son, wherever you go in your life, whatever you do, however you turn out, that's a wonderful saying which he gave, which I'll never forget. However you turn out, please remember this one thing. The door of my house will always be open to you, son. He said something like that. It had so much meaning to me, but I never understood it. I was about 14 years of age at the time, maybe. A 14-year-old boy who was emotionally, you know, just growing and didn't really know too much about, you know, that part of his world. But of course, one of the nice things, you know, is you, being a monk, you just have time. It's something which, please, I invite all of you, please don't work so hard in your life. Please find times to go on retreats, times by yourself, times you can actually allow yourself to explore some of the unexplored parts which you put off until some later time. When you haven't got time, because you're so busy looking after family, friends, you know, work and stuff, it's great to be able to have a time on retreat where you can just not try and get into deep meditations or get enlightened or stuff like that, just to see what your mind, the unfinished business it needs to bring up. And that was one of the unfinished business. What did my father mean by that? It was important, yeah. I knew that much, but I had the time as a monk to be able to explore and find out why was that such a powerful statement, which I couldn't forget? And he realized it wasn't his house, not the physical house, it was his heart. That's what he was opening up to me. And of course from that you get, whatever you do in your life, the door of my heart is open to you. Wow. When I realized that really did blow me away. It was one of the first ideas of what I know as unconditional love. Not that I love you if you behave. I love you if you always tell me where you are. I always love you if you do what I want and earn lots of money for me and just look after me in my old age and all these other things. I love you no matter what. And it was meant, it was true. And that opened up so much of my life as a mind. You're supposed to practice loving kindness and compassion for other beings and love other beings, whether it's snakes or whether it's emus or whether it's human beings. To be able to do that, to open up your heart to other beings, no matter who they are, no matter what they do. That is cosmic. That's when you come to infinity and you wonder about that. How far can you take that? You take that so far. You know, I admit I actually did this. That, you know, when Donald Trump got COVID, I chanted for his health. I don't agree at all with his policies. He's a bit of a crazy fellow, but, you know, if he's anyone who's sick, of course you'll chant for their well-being and health. And afterwards, it was natural. Why not? It's easy to do. May all beings be happy and well. Donald Trump, the door of my heart is open to you. No matter all the stupid things you do. That would be a wonderful way to heal somebody like that. People with mental disabilities, mental illness. You don't need to change. The door of my heart is open to you exactly as you are. Come in. Now that is really sort of amazing. When somebody feels that, they don't have to be different. They don't have to change. That's why I often said that in Buddhism we don't try and change people. We don't try and cure them. We care for them. It's so different, not curing but caring. And that's what you do to yourself. You don't try and cure yourself of your bad habits. You care for them. You got a wandering mind? Don't try and cure it and stop it. Care for it. And turn the wandering mind into something which is exploring. Exploring new parts of yourself, new parts of the world, new parts of who you are and how you work and how you relate to others. So wander in good places, kind places. Trouble is that a wandering mind has got a really bad rap in Buddhism, especially in meditation. No, you shouldn't have a wandering mind. People call it a monkey mind. Monkeys are okay. What's wrong with monkeys? So little by little, if you learn to love this world, open the door of your heart to it, go out in the cold snow and just appreciate just the amazing teachings of silence and solitude and peace, real deep peace. And just how you can take some words from another religion, which, you know, when I was a young Buddhist, I would just argue against like hell. Yeah, there's no God. You can't say there's a God. This is stupid stuff. And I was a theoretical physicist. I said, no. This kindness, this joy, this respect, this peace, these are wonderful things. When you wander in those areas, it does become infinite because there's no boundaries anymore. There's no, this is Christianity, this is Buddhism, this is this type of Buddhism, this is that type of Buddhism. That just drives me crazy sometimes. You know, what type of Buddhist are you, Ajahn Brahm? What tradition do you come from? I said, Buddhist tradition, if you want. I said, well, what type of Buddhism? Okay, I'll see the time, we better finish off pretty quickly and open up for questions and answers. But I tell people, and many of you have heard this before, the three main types of Buddhism, Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana. And I say, I don't like to separate them. I like to bring them all together. So this is my Buddhism. The tradition I belong to is a synergy between the three major types of Buddhism. Hinayana is like the Theravada stuff. Not really, but it's close enough. Mahayana is the Chinese type of Buddhism, and the Zen Buddhism. Vajrayana is just, you know, in brief, the Tibetan type of Buddhism. So I try and synergy. Bring them all together. No barriers, infinite. So I take the H from Hinayana. I take the next three letters, A-H-A, from Mahayana. And I take the Yana from Vajrayana. And what does that spell? Hahayana. And that's my tradition, the Hahayana Buddhism. Thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. I don't know how that went, but I didn't know what I was talking about, but there it went. So any questions about Hahayana Buddhism? Why not? Okay, some questions from overseas. Let's see what they are. I might get in trouble again. Here we go. Wow, a lot of questions today. Cassandra from Sweden. I find it hard to grasp the idea of the higher and lower realms. I wonder if I might become more clear in deep meditation if one experiences jhanas. Of course you will. So the higher realms, if you go across the border from Sweden to Norway, up there in the mountains, that's the higher realms. And the lower realms, you know, the swamps, that's where Yoda lives. So higher realms and lower realms, I don't know why we call them higher realms and lower realms, different realms, but higher and lower realms. Some beings have had made more karma, but those people who have, you know, more wealth, they're supposed to be higher beings, they have more problems as well. And those people, the ordinary little beings, living in their little houses, they have much more freedom and happiness than the mega wealthy people. I've seen mega wealthy people. I went to this one person's house over in Kuala Lumpur, and I couldn't believe as I was driving in, they had guards at the gate with machine guns. He wasn't a general or anything. He was just a very wealthy person, but he was having to guard his house with guards with machine guns. And I thought, does this guy live in a mansion or does he live in a prison? It looked more like a prison than a mansion. For me, I live in a cave. Got far more freedom. But the higher and lower realms of, like, other beings, that's really cool. So maybe one day you see a ghost or a heavenly being. And heavenly beings exist. Amazing beings. But anyway, one day you just leave that on the back burner for now. Just you don't have to really decide whether you want to believe this or not. But as a theoretical physicist, unfortunately there is evidence. These things actually exist. Why not? Isn't it nice? There's just so many different parts of existence which we don't really know about. You get into deep meditation and you start to explore these things. Ooh, amazing stuff. You don't need to feel afraid as well. Snakes won't harm you. Ghosts will never harm you. And other beings, they can't harm you. Sometimes, like, a person who is having a mental breakdown or something, they can shout and scream or whatever, they won't harm you. If you've got kindness, you're not afraid. So even these other beings are suffering so much, and a monk or meditator or nun can give them so much kindness, and that will calm them down. Anyway, from Indonesia, Ajahn, do you have any advice for teenagers who are struggling to finding their talent, hobby or passion, having no idea what career to pick up in the future? Please help, thank you. Look, I never thought I'd become a Buddhist monk when I was young, as a teenager. That was weird. I think I told a story that when I went to Thailand to become a monk, I thought I'd go there for 2 years, get enlightened, then come back and carry on my life, find a nice girl to get married and start a job. I had no idea what life was. That's why life is for exploring. So don't make decisions yet. Teenagers struggling, finding their talent, hobby or passion, just first of all believe in yourself. Have that confidence, which is most important. And if you've got sort of someone in your family who gives you that amazing gift, that's the best inheritance I ever got from my father. when he said, "The door of my heart's open to you, son, no matter where you ever go in your life." Wow. That was worth more than $1 billion, honestly, to get a teaching like that, which is worth much more than any money. So anyway, you find that life, and sometimes you explore this way, that way, and all over the ways, and you go back again, and sometimes you find something. And when you find that something, just when I became a monk, first 3 days in robes, I had nightmares. Honestly. Monks know this story. I woke up in the middle of the night in Bangkok. Nightmare. You know what my nightmare was? That I was a layperson. Honest. And I remember that I would open my eyes in the middle of the night, and I'd see my robes by the way. I've ordained. I've made it. Yay! I just turned over and went into this really beautiful, peaceful sleep. And that told me something. That, you know, this was going to be for a long time. This was, you know, I discovered by chance, by karma, I don't know, that this was my life, being a monk. I found out at 23, this was a wonderful thing. Now, I told people I'd like to be a monk forever. Yeah, they all say that. Nah, I'm still a monk. I mean, a monk, we had my 46th birthday as a monk. What day is it today? It was actually last week, last Friday. Is it 12th today or 11th? 11th, okay, yeah, 6 days ago. 46 years as a monk and still going strong. So that's where your hobby and passion, just believe in, don't be afraid. And just check out just where your talents lead you. Everyone's got incredible talents. From New South Wales, in a time of uncertainty with the possible loss of jobs, income and a roof over our heads, I feel like we need something to trust to keep us hopeful. Can you suggest to us those things that we should trust? That the Dhamma is one, that karma is another one. What else? It's again just you. Trust in yourself. That you'll survive. You don't survive, but you do wonderful things. Trust in kindness. You know, there's so many kind people in this world. And it's not just, you know, because I'm a monk, people are kind to me. But, you know, sometimes that people surprise you. You need a job, and somebody comes up and finds a job for you. I think I saw her earlier. It was the woman who had a little dog. And she came to Perth and trying to find a share house where she and her dog could stay. Is she still here? Girl with the dog? Oh, if anyone, I don't know where she's gone to, but she came to me a couple of weeks ago. You know, she has this beautiful little dog, very lovely, you know, young woman, who's trying to find a share house where her dog and her could be accepted. So if anyone has a share house like that or can help out, please let me know. I'll find her somewhere. I think her Anusha has the details. So trust in other people. And if you give trust to another person, that's such a valuable thing. And don't sort of throw it away because someone makes a mistake. Or because someone's in a bad mood that day and they just shout at you, they say something wrong. There's a kindness, there's a love, which can allow other person to actually to say rude things to you. Simply because they think you can understand it. They're not criticizing you. They're criticizing themselves and just their reactions to the very difficult day they've had. It's one of the reasons why if your partner comes back and just is really upset, give them a big hug. Don't get angry back. Don't fight ill will with more ill will. What do you mean by that? Just say, "Oh, you poor thing. You must have had such a difficult day today. Let's go out for dinner or something." Surprise them that way, giving kindness back when they mistreat you. Anyway, this is from South Australia. I am new to Buddhism. What is the difference between the brain and the mind? What role does the brain have in mindfulness and meditation? Love your talk, Sachin Pa. The brain is temporary. It only lasts your lifetime. But the mind, the stream of consciousness, goes from life to life. It's much bigger. The brain, where does the brain live? The brain lives in your head. Where does your mind live? Okay, I've got time for this. This is a classic story, which is in one of my books. I'm sure you've heard it before. This was one of my friends, first grade at school. First grade kids are marvellous because they are free from education. In other words, they have original ideas which haven't been stifled by our systems. So, when the teacher was asking the question, what's the biggest thing in the world? You've heard the story before, it's a beautiful bit of logic. My daddy, said one kid. No, an elephant. No, a mountain. And the kid, the six-year-old child of one of my friends from university, said, no, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. And it shut everyone up. What do you mean? That was totally unexpected. What do you mean your eye is the biggest thing in the world? And she said, this is amazing logic. Well, my eye can see her father. My eye can see an elephant. My eye can see a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye, my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. That's actually brilliant. And I let people know that eventually she, as many years ago, she became a PhD professor in, I think, biochemistry or something in Oxford. So, you know, she was showing signs even in that age of just thinking amazingly well. But anyway, I wrote back and said, yeah, 9 out of 10, but you haven't gone all the way yet. Because your mind can see everything your eye can see, and it can imagine things you'll never see in this real world. You can hear real and imaginary sounds. You can smell, taste, touch real feelings and phantom feelings. And it's got its own amazing place of knowledge, what the mind knows. If all of that, all that you can ever experience, can fit into the mind is the biggest thing. Not in the world, because the world can fit into your mind. And the brain can fit into your mind, not the other way around. That's really cool logic. And it sees things in a different way. You're changing your perceptions, because sometimes our perceptions are so limited, so finite. This is infinitizing your perceptions. Anyway, from Poland. When I meditate, a great fear of death comes. The fear is paralyzing. I'm trying to accept it every time, but this fear becomes an obstacle. What can I do to achieve peace in meditation? You get fear of death when you're meditating. How many times have you died in meditation? None. So it's a fear without any ground to it. But what actually are you afraid of? It's not actually the fear of death. It's almost like a fear of a spiritual type of death, of losing control, losing your sense of self, the one which will always try and protect you. And it doesn't protect you, it just causes you lots of stress and problems. So little by little, just keep on meditating a tiny bit more, and you find that you push back the barrier of that fear. Little by little, you go deeper into the meditation, you find it's wonderful. And after a while, you find, what on earth was I afraid of? This is great, this is beautiful, this is blissful. Don't try to overcome it all at once. Just little by little, push it back a little bit, and a little bit more, a little bit more. And you'll find that what you're afraid of was actually nothing worth being afraid of at all. We're afraid of so many things in life. A lot of the time, afraid of ghosts. You know this is true, that ghosts can give you lottery numbers. These are true stories, which I know that, yeah, they've given real lottery numbers. So I did see a sign, was it $3 million tomorrow? Is that right? I think I saw it on a sign somewhere coming in today. Do you want $3 million tomorrow? Anyone want $3 mil? Do you need that? Would that be a nice boost to your finances? If it is, maybe go to Fremantle Cemetery tonight. And see if you can find a ghost. Say, hey, come on, ghost. So no need to be afraid of stuff. Okay, last question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, being a scientist, how do you explain stillness in scientific terms? You explain not stillness in scientific terms, you explain science in stillness terms. So you change the importance and the priority. What is science? And I remember just the founders of science, which was, the fellow I often quote who did absolute zero. What's the name? The temperature? Kelvin, Lord Kelvin. He was actually a scientist and a bit of a philosopher as well. And he said, the only way that science should continue is a way of the negative. So he said that people should put their proposals up, the science, just like the law of gravity or something. And then all the scientists should try their best to disprove it. Because he said you can never really prove anything. Or you can actually show you haven't seen a fault yet. But once you see a fault and you know it was wrong, then you can improve it. Unfortunately, science these days, and I say this as a scientist, they don't try and disprove a theory because there's too much peer, not pressure, but peer involvement in making sure that you know, this particular theory works. And so there's not that same sense of breaking new barriers in science as there was some years ago. People are not courageous enough to try and disprove science. Science has become a bit too dogmatic, like religion became too dogmatic. This is my theory, and you're not going to disprove it. So, stillness goes beyond those theories. Stillness, you can know that yourself. You don't need to sort of read a scientific explanation of stillness. Every one of you has moments of stillness. And if we can notice them, that's maybe the best part of this talk tonight. If you can notice stillness, you know what it is. And really get to be a friend of stillness. That will create so much great happiness, health, and innovation. Last little exercise. What's this which I'm holding up? What is it? Yeah, it's a bell. What else is it? Come on, describe it. Give me some more descriptions. Maybe I've done this before. People say it's a piece of wood, it's got cloth on the top, it's maybe about 9 inches long, it's cylindrical, blah, blah, blah. After a while, you haven't got any words for this anymore. All the old concepts of what you thought this was, what you were told it was, get exhausted. And now your mind becomes still. You can't think anymore because you've exhausted all your knowledge, everything you've been told what this is. And then, you can start to see it afresh. You can innovate it with this. Well, that feels really nice. Yeah, I should have done that a long time ago. That's where you get breakthroughs in science. Not by taking a thought or concept and just taking it deeper, by stopping it. By being still. And I told a story like that. That was one of the best stories I gave at the World Computer Conference in Daejeon in 2018, I think, when I gave the keynote address there. Hey, what's a Buddhist monk doing giving a keynote address at a World Computer Conference? I'm not any good at these things, but I'm very good at doing things differently. So there we go. So any questions from the floor before we begin? Oh yeah, from the back there. Could you come close to one of the... microphone, yeah.
Hi.
Hi. Is that your question?
No.
Very good.
Just about like kind of science and physics and all that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, scientists believe that the brain is the mind and, you know, when you die, like the brain is dead and, you know, there's nothing. I believe in an afterlife, but I am kind of interested in neuroscience, and sometimes I'll watch those kind of things, and you know, I've just got that interest in it. That sometimes I do get quite terrified because it kind of it makes me
skeptical,
and I'm just thinking, is what they're saying really true? And what if there's nothing afterwards? And like, how do you kind of, I don't know, I mean, that's science. That's like, it's black and white. This is how it is. But, you know, how do you have that faith? And, I mean, I do believe in an afterlife, but it's, I don't know. It's just...
Now, look, there's many scientists. And just to make the point that when we had our last conference, global conference here in Perth, the convention centre, I invited one of my friends, who is called Professor Bernard Carr, Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics in Queen Mary College, London University. And I never realized just how close a disciple of Stephen Hawking he was until he told me, and I just watched the film on the airplane once, that film of the life of Stephen Hawking. And Bernard said, you know, he was actually featured in it. One of Stephen Hawking's close assistant researchers. And he, you know, wasn't actually in the movie, but he actually got to go on the red carpet in the opening of the, what's it called, the premiere in Leicester Square. And he was just a theoretical physicist. But he was also my mate, who was a Buddhist, the first Buddhist I ever met. And also... We joined together. We had so much common interests of the Psychic Research Society. We'd go hunting ghosts together. He was one of what I call the real scientists who'd break down barriers. And he was the president of the London Society of Psychic Research and gave so many wonderful anecdotes about life beyond this world. And he was a hard-nosed theoretical physicist. The evidence is not sort of, what was it called, X-Files. The evidence is out there. This is in there. And to me, quite frankly, it's been proven beyond any sort of doubt that things like rebirth, reincarnation exist. There are such things as ghosts and other sort of life forms. There's people who do have near-death experiences. And they're brain is just not working, it's not functioning, and it's still very much alive. There's so much evidence out there. It's one of the reasons that, you know, I sort of get a bit frustrated with some scientists. They refuse actually to follow the evidence, because it's too tough for them. So I'm quite with you, there is such a thing as rebirth. And when you pass away, you won't pass away. You just continue to go on to your next life, in between lives. See what happens next. Look, sometimes I ask this question, how many of you have seen or heard a ghost? A few people? Yeah, okay, there's a few people. Are you crazy people? You're not at all. These things are real. Sometimes people have seen, but they refuse to admit it. Or they hear and they think it's something else. Or that something has tried to connect you, but you're just in denial. You just, this is too scary. No, no, thank you. It's nice being a monk, you don't have that fear. The weird thing about, I've got to stop talking after this, going on too long. The weird thing is, what I found is that ghosts are afraid of you. Weird. So, monastery in Tana where I lived was a cremation ground. There's lots of ghosts there. So remember, just early years as a monk, just went out to see the ghosts. And the ghosts, you can see us! They were terrified that a monk could actually see them. Weird. Anyway, there we go, a little anecdote to finish off with. Da 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 da. Oh, Eddie, you're too late now. Next week. Okay, you've got in the back there. There's another one.
Hello. Just following on. Something's really bothering me. My dogs are very old. How do I make sure that they're going to have a good life?
Next life. There are such things as ghost dogs as well. There's two cases of ghost dogs. There's one fellow I'm going to see him next Friday. That, you know, his next door neighbour, sort of, his dog passed away. Did I tell the story last week or a week ago? His next door neighbour's dog passed away. Died in his arms. Had to take him to the vet and get sort of euthanized. The next morning, he was about to go to work, opened the front door of his house, and the dog sort of came in. And he said it looked exactly the same as his dog. But he couldn't have been, because he was euthanized the night before. And so he came in, and he just went to every corner of his house where the dog would usually curl up, just for a few seconds. And he said he went to the back of the house, there was always a leaky tap, and that's where the dog would get a drink when it was thirsty. And then went up, it was one of these units, and went upstairs. And this man's wife, you know, this is a builder, this man, and his wife has not got out of bed yet. And the dog would always, before he'd go to work with the master, the building site, would always go up to his wife and just kiss. And the wife was half asleep and forgot the dog had died. And so when the dog went up and kissed, she kissed the ghost. And then the dog went downstairs. She found out later on. And you know, she wasn't afraid at all. She thought, what a wonderful thing that was. So the dog went out of the front door, and the owner was about to go into his ute to go to work as a builder. And the dog went to jump in, and he said, no, that's enough. You've got to go. So the dog turned around and ran down the street, never seen again. The ghost dog, one last visit to the house of where it lived for so many years, and just even kissing the owner. And when your dog died, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing the ghost came and gave you a kiss? Yeah, so never underestimate dogs, and they're good people. Good dog. Yeah, good animals, yeah. Okay, look, I can keep going. Okay, Eddie, you got a long question or short question? We already... Yeah, say something, because it's not the same without Eddie saying something. Be quick. If somebody needs to go, please go. So make it very quick.
You talk about God, you know, God.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, in the Buddha's teaching, he emphasized a lot on mind, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Mind, yeah. You know, mind is foreigner of all states, you know. Yeah, yeah. And then he was telling us his teaching is on suffering and ending of suffering. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in the Buddhist cosmology, you know, okay,
yeah.
31 planes of existence, the 14th plane, that's the plane of great Brahma, you know.
Yeah.
Great God, you know, that is.
Yeah, but it's not really a God like
that. So what do you think of as of great Brahma in the...
Oh, no, the great Brahma is just somebody who has first jhana experience.
Oh.
So I think it's in brief. So that's not sort of the creator of this world or anything. And it's much nicer, instead of having like hard and fast cosmologies about the nature of the mind, and make it more emotional. That's why... What are people searching for? Make God something more real, something which all people can worship. Don't you worship respect, love and kindness and peace, meaning? That's what real emotional truth. And that's something which everyone can believe in and agree on. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eddie. Okay, so that's now, for those of you who haven't fallen asleep and left. Pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Thank you for all the questions.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang namasami. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghang namami.
Oops. I stiffened up.